Okay, it's 9 o'clock. It's time to start. I see. I think a lot of people already took are on their vacations, but it's okay as long as we have a few, and the rest will hear it later. We're gonna finish up today with the Rav Zalman Meltzer, and if we finish early enough, we'll start with Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. If not, I'm not gonna start. If only 15 minutes left to go, we'll then be able to start the next semester fresh. Before we start, though, I just want to, especially since this is our last time this semester, I want to pick up on, finish up on some things, questions I was asked here. First, you can see the picture there. That is Rav Shlomo Polacek, the Mechitor, who we spoke about 2 classes ago, known as the Mechitor Eloi. We've spoken a good deal about him. As I said, he dies young at the age of 51. I think it's 1929. And that enables Rav Moshe Soloveitchik to be brought to America, which then leads Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik to come to America. Talmid Mufak, leading student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. However, we all not only have a picture of him, we have a picture of his wife, his Rebbetzin. Here she is. Oh, sorry, actually, before we get to that, there's even a street named after the Mechitor in the land of Israel. In case you're wondering why there's a street named after the Mechitor in the land of Israel, why should there be named after a Rosh Yeshiva? You don't have streets named after, well, now you do in places like B'nai Brak, but this goes way back, and it's, you see it in English even. It mentions Rav Shlomo Polacek of Mechit. This goes back, it might even go back before there was a state of Israel. Or if not, actually probably not based on the sign, but the early years, you didn't, it's in Jerusalem. You don't have Rosh Yeshiva, especially not if, even in B'nai Brak, if you go today, you're not going to have the Mechitor. You're going to either have Israeli Rosh Yeshiva or you're going to have a world-renowned Rosh Yeshiva. So how is it that the Mechitor gets a, and here for those who just came on late, here's the picture of the Mechitor. How is it that he gets a street? Well, because even though he's a leading student of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, after that he taught at Rav Rinus's yeshiva, the Lida yeshiva, the Yeshiva Lida, which was a Zionist Mizrahi yeshiva. So many of the students of this yeshiva became leading activists in Mizrahi, religious Zionism, came on Aliyah, and were involved in building the state. So they also were not just involved in building the state, they were involved in setting up the streets. Although, as I mentioned, even in the days of the British, you still had Jewish streets. Most streets were not set up in that way. You had all sorts of streets going back early on, and they gave them political names. But once Israel became a state, then they had to name all the streets, let's say, in Jerusalem. Although again, it's not true what I'm saying. There, not many of the streets are even during the mandate period. But I'm pretty certain this is not. But in any event, they had to name all the streets. And if you know your way around Jerusalem, you know that different areas, for example, political figures are in one area, Zionist leaders in another one, medieval Hebrew poets, they're in another one. And the Eloi Mechit, because he had students among the early Zionist leaders in the land of Israel, religious Zionist leaders, they ensured that he get a street named after him. It's in that area of Nachlaot. I looked it up on the computer before. One more picture. Here is the Rebbetzin of the Mechitor. If you're looking at her, you may be wondering, well, she doesn't look like a Rebbetzin. Obvious, you see, she's not covering her hair, but as we've said so many times, in those days, in the early 20th century, until really the late 1970s, even early 80s, among the typical Lithuanian Rebbetzin, of the younger rabbis, certainly, but even not just the younger rabbis, the women generally did not cover their hair. It's not just Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have Rav Ruderman and many others, the typical Rosh Yeshiva at YU and many other great rabbis. This is how they looked. And I'm talking about the wives of Gedolim, Gedoli, Gedoli Yisrael. And we've talked in the past of why that was the case. And I mentioned to you what Rabbi Simcha Zelig, no, his grandson, Rav Golevsky, told me. So That's it for the Maitre. For those who just came in, I'll show you quickly here. The Maitre. Oops, sorry, there's the Maitre, but I explained how it is that he. Oh, sorry, not again. How it is that he has a street named after him in Jerusalem, Ir HaKodesh. But if you missed what I just said about the Maitre and his street and other things, you can pick it up the first minute or so on the tape. A couple other things before we start. I looked around right after the class, right after last class. I wanted to see some stuff about Rav Eliyahu Klatskin, and I just plugged his name in, and this pops up. Makarab Alvayata Rav Eliyahu Klatskin, and it tells the whole story that I told you last week about how at Rav Eliyahu Klatskin's funeral, they didn't allow the body to be. What the story is, it's told here, is that the body was not allowed to be brought into the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, even though Rav Kook was waiting, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Rav Isher Zalman, Rav Charlap, Rav Hasman, and others, because they didn't want Rav Kook to, you know, the extremist, grab the body and refuse to allow it to be brought into the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. But when this was reported in the Aguda paper, Kol Yisrael, what does it say? All it says is that there was no hespedim in the courtyard of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva because it wasn't enenamakom imamad. It's not a place to have hespedim. I mean, here's another example of how this paper refuses to acknowledge what its own adherents, the Aguda people, did by not, young people, that is the hotheads, by not allowing the body to be brought in to be given hespedim. There's a couple comments on this post that appeared on. There's a blog called Am HaSefer, and one of them is from the great Eitam Henkin, who points out some things. So it was sad to read that. One final thing, I mentioned Yaakov Klatskin last time, the son of the great Rabbi Eliyahu Klatskin, this unbelievable Gadol B'Yisrael. And how the son, who traditional yeshiva education, wrote Chidushei Torah, then becomes completely irreligious. I said he's an atheist. He intermarried, and interesting story. One of our listeners, Shlomo, he looked up a little, and he sent me something from Wikipedia. Very nice entry, Hebrew entry, no English entry. And it tells a story, but and it mentions what I said, how he was a complete Spinozist. That is, Yaakov Klatskin was, you know, completely removed from religion. But it says something in the article that a memoir, part of a memoir that Yaakov Klatskin wrote, in which he says, in which you see from this, as Wikipedia says, that his whole life, despite his views, he didn't stop having a dialogue with it says even though he's far removed from the faith of his fathers, he didn't stop having a dialogue with it until the end of his lives. And what is life? And what does this passage say? He says, "Those who know me, even those who know me very well, my ideas and my lifestyle the last 40 years, especially those who know me well, will not be able to believe and find it impossible to believe that sometimes I put on a tallit and I put on a tefillin and I daven be yechidut al geulat Yisrael." Mitocher dat kodesh, from the fear of, you know, the holy awe, and b'chiyot memushachot, and crying, just like one of my holy fathers. So, and he says, they also won't believe that sometimes I even get up at night and say, tikkun chatzot. So Shlomo says, well, doesn't this show that even though publicly outside he was a Spinozist and he had no connection to religion, you know, he's a great Zionist also, but he never went to the land of Israel. That's the interesting thing. He intermarries and he doesn't go to Israel. But doesn't this show that he at least maybe came back to religion or always was attached to religion? And my comment was, it sounds to me, just reading that passage, this is nostalgia. Basically, he's a Spinozist, he's an atheist, he's a pantheist, whatever he is. Occasionally, he has nostalgia and he prays. Does that, you know, Mordechai Kaplan also prayed. Does that mean that he's actually thinking that God is going to hear him and answer him? Lots of people pray, even though they don't believe they don't believe. As I said, Mordechai Kaplan. I'm going to India in a short while. In India, you have this group called the Jains. They pray also. You know, they have big statues there, and they have they leave you know, offerings and everything at the statue, but they don't believe in God. They don't, or gods. So what's the point of praying? It's all about internally to purify yourself. And so I say, Shlomo, that I don't think that passage shows that he was, as modern Hebrew would say, poseach al shnei seipim, that he's going from side to side. He was a Spinozist, and but again, he had nostalgia. It's he grew up in the house of one of the great Gedolim. Okay, let's continue. Let me put up a picture of Isser Zalman here. We're going to finish up with Rabbi Isser Zalman. I want to pick up where we left off. We told the thing we finished with was the story of the trial where Rav Kook was executed. And I mentioned that in addition to Menachem Porush being expelled, they also fired the person the Menahel Cheshbonot. I translated that as accountant of the Yitzchayim Yeshiva. That's not what it is. It's the one in charge of the finances. They had a guy working at the Yitzchayim Yeshiva who was actually a real extremist. How he thought he could get away with being involved with that trial and not be fired, I don't know. But he was fired as well. Now, this event, as I mentioned last week, was to have a long lifespan in the land of Israel. And Menachem Porush never lived it down. He himself confessed to that fact. But I want to read you something that Ritzi Yehuda Cook mentions. This is found in Le'Netivot Yisrael, which is Ritzi Yehuda's collected writings, but before that it appeared in Hatzofeh. It appeared in Or HaMizrach, which is published by the Mizrahi in America. And but it's very easy to have it. If volume 2 and page 558, it's a letter addressed to her Rav Yitzchak Meir Levin Shlita of Agudat Yisrael. Yitzchak Meir Levin, or known as Itcha Meir, the son-in-law of the Gera Rebbe, one of the signatories to the Israeli Declaration of Independence. As I mentioned, although the Agudas Yisrael had all these extremists and fanatics, Naturei Karta, and that's something that maybe one day Agudas Yisrael will answer for, because as we spoke about, they really need to take responsibility when one day the history is written, even the official history, for what happened under their watch. But it got to be so bad that in 1945, the Aguda breaks with the Eda Charedit. What happened was at the elections for the Eda Charedit offices in 1945, the Naturei Karta forces win. And this is 1945. By then, you know, they're so removed, the Aguda. After the Holocaust, it's obvious that you have to cooperate and create a state. And all the immigrants who came to the land of Israel from Poland and from Lithuania wanted nothing to do with the Eda Charedit, which was really run by the Naturei Karta types. So finally, the official break happens in 1945, and the Agudas Yisrael, and then and then Naturei Karta, instead of attacking the Mizrahi and instead of attacking the Zionists, then it turns on the Aguda. Because, you know, nothing's worse than someone who is regarded as a traitor. But Naturei Karta was a part of Agudas Yisrael until then. So in 19, this letter is from 1954. Rav Itcha Meir Levin writes to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Remember again, Rav Itcha Meir Levin from the Ger Rebbe, the son-in-law. He accompanied the Ger Rebbe on trips of his to the land of Israel before World War II. The famous meeting with Rav Kook. The Ger Rebbe and the Ger Hasidim always had a close tie to Rav Kook. And that's the Agudas Yisrael that was the moderate Agudas Yisrael, which couldn't handle the extremists in the land of Israel and who never would have made this agreement. This agreement was made because of the German Orthodox. The one thing that was so important to them was Auschwitz separatism. They could not stomach. If they fought for separatism in Germany, the idea that they'd be connected with people like Rav Kook or Tzvi Pesach Frank and you know, the chief rabbinate, which had a connection to the Vahd HaLeumi, which encompassed both religious and non-religious, that broke with their principles of Auschwitz, and therefore they prefer to go with these extremists in the Eda Charedit than to be with the Torah leaders of, let's say, Lithuania and Poland, who now were in the land of Israel. So Ritzi Yehuda writes a letter to Rav Itcha Meir Levin. Why does he write a letter? Because Rav Itcha Meir Levin invited Ritzi Yehuda to attend the Agudas Yisrael Knesiyah HaGdolah, the great gathering, which they have every how many years? Remember, Rav Kook was invited for the great Knesiyah that was taking place in 1914. He leaves the land of Israel. It was the only time he left the land of Israel since his arrival there 10 years earlier. And he goes there. Unfortunately, World War I breaks out, and the Knesiyah is canceled, and then he makes his way to Switzerland and England, only returning to the land of Israel in 1919. But the first Aguda Knesiyah invited Rav Kook because he was one of the Gedolim, and Rav Kook wanted to go and speak about the importance of the land of Israel. So it only makes sense that when they had the Knesiyah in Jerusalem, they'd invite Rav Kook's son, Ritzi Yehuda Kook, especially now that Agudas Yisrael has removed this element, this Neturei Karta, this separatist element, and Agudas Yisrael was part of the Israeli government. Itamar Levin was a member of parliament. He was the last member of parliament, incidentally. After him, Agudas Yisrael reverts to a sort of anti-Zionist perspective or non-Zionist, even though they're in the government, and even though they are in Knesset, they refuse to take a position of minister. Instead, they only take deputy minister. I mean, it was all a game, because the deputy minister ran the ministry, but they didn't want to give acknowledgement to the state, even though Itamar Levin had been a member of a minister. It was only last year that, with the new government, after the new elections, it's a little more than a year now, that Agudas Yisrael, the Degel Torah, now finally changed its tune, and they allowed this deputy, what's it, Litzman, to become minister of health, I believe he is. But that was the first time since the very first Knesset that the Agudas Yisrael, now Degel Torah people, actually agreed to be a minister. But throughout all those years, we're talking 50 or 50 years, they refused to be a minister in the government because that would have meant that they were connected more to the state apparatus than they wanted to be. So you see with Itamar Levin, after him, the more extreme forces, even in Aguda, exert influence. So Tzvi Yehuda is invited. What does Tzvi Yehuda reply to him? He says, well, thank you for the invitation, and he says that it's very good that, well, it actually doesn't say thank you, because I received your invitation. It's a very positive thing that, there's a gathering to strengthen Torah. And then, therefore, I have to reply to your request, because I can't be one who is called upon to do a mitzvah, but doesn't, is not part of it. However, then he says, my father, Rav Avram Kook, he wrote a letter which is published, and he says, to the first Agudas Yisrael convention, and he talks about how when I was in Germany in 1914 in Halberstadt, I was involved with the Youth Aguda, which he was, and okay, we don't need to go into that, but then he says, things have developed, unfortunately, from then until now, and the important holy values that used to exist, that Rav Avram Kook wrote to Aguda about, and what he says that when I was with the Aguda youth in Halberstadt, I was able to establish the importance of God's revealing Himself and bringing people to come return. That is, that the Jewish people are once again becoming a people, as it were, being able to return to the land of Israel. He says, however, everything has changed. And then he says, I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking now. How can I participate in your gathering? B'shem HaTorah B'Mitzvah, in the name of Torah and Mitzvah, shel oto guf tzibori, from this organization, Asher me'az heyoto hu marbe perudim b'Yisrael, from its beginning, it creates separatism in Israel, and makes it as if there are two Torot in Israel, which separates. And then he quotes the Netziv, who's against separatism. And then he says, and furthermore, how can I participate with you in the Agudas Yisrael, which in its name, Bishmo HaMefarash, remember, Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel, The problem is, you'll see that it's a bit unfair because the Buddhist rule in Poland had nothing to do with this, or sort of had nothing to do with it. I'll explain. Asher bishmohama farash, with Aguda's name, uvenasiati glow, and carrying the torch of Aguda, nasta befarhesya otaha vodah hatmeya b'meshach shanim mirabot. For many years, terrible things happened. Avodah hatmeya. What did he show in the land of Israel? Katzeret yimei chayav she'adoni avi mori, which shortened the life of my father. That is all the things, the attacks, the I mean, Rav Kook needed guards sometimes. I mean, the terrible things they did. They threw water on him once he was walking down the street. I mean, unbelievable stuff they did to Rav Kook, which Rav Kook says shortened their life. Chabot ora sholom. And then it says, and then it goes on, v'chunchu ne'arim, and because of how the Aguda elders in the land of Israel treated my father. Remember how they treated him? They treated him by abusing him, by debasing him, by putting up Pashkevillim, attacking him, constantly trying to make him into a nothing and a nobody, a Russia, all that stuff. The young people were educated in this. V'chunchu ne'arim, Noar Agudat Yisrael. This led to the young people being educated, liyot ma'umanim b'mischak lirtsoach nefesh, shel Adoni Avi Mori v'Rabi. They were this, gave them the education so that they could create this game, this event that we spoke about, to kill the lirtsoach nefesh, to kill my father. V'gam huzman kal anashim lirot b'machazet tuma. And he says, and people, a large crowd of people, were invited to come hear this, to come watch this impure performance. Asher me'az v'ad heina lo nishmu, which we've never heard of such a thing. And this happened mitzad oto guf tzibur. This happened out of the Aguda. And what do we see from this? Oh no, sorry. He says asher me'az v'ad heina, and from then, from 1932 until today, Lo nishma'u, we've not heard, mitzad oto guf tziburi, from this organization, namely Agudas Yisrael, afilu shum divrei charata uvidui hazeh, not one word of charata, of regret, and for that confession, ela adarabba. But on the contrary, acharei divrei harav istagut mitzad aguda mivorsa, when the local aguda in Warsaw came out with a strong protest. The newspaper reports came back to the land of Israel about this terrible thing, and the Agudas Yisrael in Warsaw, they launched a strong protest. Nevertheless, despite that, he says, that is the people in the land of Israel, the Agudists in there, they added more, kept attacking Rav Kook. And what Rav Tzvi Yehuda says is, I can't be part of an organization that, although the local chapters of the organization came out against this, the national organization refused to, and that is absolutely the case. There were letters, not just after this, but there were letters throughout all this period from Germany, from the office in Frankfurt, harsh letters to the land of Israel, telling them you can't do this, you can't treat Rav Kook this way, it's embarrassing. How can you do this? We have letters from the other Gedolim in Aguda protesting this, but what we don't have is an actual protest from the official Agudas Yisrael office condemning this, or Tzvi Yehuda would have wanted a complete break. And the reason for that was because they didn't feel that this was enough to cause them to cut their ties. Because if they would have cut their ties with the Yed HaCharedit, with the Aguda in the land of Israel, then they would have had to join with the chief rabbinate, and that they couldn't do. That is, the German group couldn't do. And it was only in 1945 when finally they had enough. And then he goes on to say, if our sages tell us that when you deal with a chatat yachid, an individual sinner, that one who is who mevaza tamid chacham ein lo refuah makato, if you degrade a tamid chacham, there's no cure for that. How much more so when we're dealing with not an individual person who degrades a tamid chacham, but a whole community? And then he says at the end, and remember, Itshel Meir Levin is someone he's friendly with. It's Dafka the Gerer Hasidim that were the biggest fans of Rav Kook and the defenders of Rav Kook in the Aguda. But Itshel Meir Levin is writing him this letter in the name of Agudas Yisrael, the organization. So he says, I've at the end, he says, the Hirureva Vavi, you know, my thoughts, which I'm giving you now, they're not just personal thoughts to me, but they reflect, you know, they're a public thing, Inyan Ochol B'nei Yisrael, they reflect all of Israel, and therefore I'm actually going to be publicizing this letter, which he did, and it appeared in HaTzofeh and other places. So we see that although there was all this degradation and debasing of Rav Kook by the Aguda forces in the land of Israel, you see from Tzvi Yehuda's letter, and we knew without the letter, but it's reflected here in the letter, 22 years after the event, that you know, this incident where which leads Rav Zalman Meltzer to never daven in that shul again, and to expel the student from Eitz Chaim and from his yeshiva over this. This is something that still remains with Tzvi Yehuda, and you know, it can't be forgotten. And he holds the entire Agudas Yisrael, and he would always hold the entire Agudas Yisrael, although he was very close with many people in Agudas Yisrael, very friendly with Rav Yecheskel Sarna and Rav Yecheskel Abramsky and others. He always distinguished between the individual Gedolim of Agudas Yisrael. Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski, who was the head of Motzos Gedolei Torah, Tzvi Yehuda always distinguished between the individual Gedolim, who deserve the greatest respect, and the organization itself, which he thought to be Tamei, impure. And I think he probably also convinced himself of something which was also an idea which you find of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and others, that at the end of the day, the Aguda is not run by the Gedolim. The Aguda is run by the Askanim. You have explicit statements of this by a Gedolim who never joined the Aguda, and therefore he feels, as I read it, he feels that there's no contradiction between seeing the Aguda itself as an impure force while at the same time having respect for the Gedolim, although I find that a little difficult because what is the Aguda if not the Gedolim who take part in it? But that's the first thing I want to call your attention to. But that Rav Tzvi Yehuda was not done. Let me read you something else. This history is completely unknown in the typical Agudistan. If they'll never let me speak there, but if you know, some miracle happened, and someone asked me to actually give a talk at the Aguda Convention, the history of Agudas Yisrael, I'd speak about the history of Agudas Yisrael. They don't even know today that it's founded in Germany, and they don't know about the great dispute between the Germans and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. The German leadership didn't want to allow rabbis who were in communities that you know, joint communities in, as part of the leadership, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik wouldn't have that. So I mean, I could speak, but then you know, it's this too. I'd like to speak. I'd like to at least enlighten. I'd have to get my black hat and put it on. But I think Agudas people should know that. Look, we know there's problems with Mizrahi. We've spoke about it, and you know what they did with Reb Chaim Moser Grzinski, putting up Rabbi Rubinstein instead of Rabbi Chaim Moser. That's not a shining moment in Mizrahi, and there's other examples as well. But I don't think so. We know that, but I don't think the Agudas Yisrael people have any clue that their organization, which they love to, you know, put up there as so pure and everything, was involved, as Tzvi Yehuda says, in at least one of its branches, and it was never cut off as shortening the life of Rav Kook. If you recall, when I quoted Porush from last week, not only did he deny that he had anything to do with it, he refers to Rav Kook as one of the Gedolim. He says, and I certainly would not be involved in anything negative against the Gedolim. There's one other thing I want to call your attention to, and that's published proclamations or Tzvi Yehuda Kook. You see it here with Hilchot Tzibur, which is an interesting way of saying, you know, public thoughts. On page 118, he says, this is Cruz. You know, proclamation number 130, and in the back of it here, it gives doesn't give the description of it, but it during Rav Gorin's time as chief rabbi, you know about the Langer dispute we had. So who came out against Rav Gorin in the Knesset? None other than Porush. Porush attacks Rav Gorin for not following the views of the Gedolei Yisrael and going off on his own. And doing this heter that allows the children to marry and not be regarded as mamzerim. So what does Tzvi Yehuda say? This is a letter, a public letter that was, when I say public letter, it would have been published in HaTzofeh. They might have put it up in Mea Shearim on the walls. These statements of Tzvi Yehuda, they would hang them everywhere. He himself lived in, I think, Geula. He says, "Nizdazati." I'm shocked to read, the horrible things written in Shel Oto Hechatzuf from this Mechutzaf. Who's this Mechutzaf? So he says, which according to Chazal, now this is 1978. This is the event happened in 32, so we're talking 46 years later. He says, and according to Chazal, Masechet Taanit, it's permitted to call him a Rasha, and it's permitted to hate him. And Rashi over there says, even though it says V'haltaracha kamocha, Yotze, such a person, that is, who degrades Torah scholars, you don't have to love him. On the contrary, you're supposed to hate him. Who is this Chatzuf? Asher Biza Barabim Bashato Maran Abba Harav Zatzal, who degraded publicly my father, Zatzal. And therefore, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer Zatzal, Azav Beit HaKnesset, and therefore, Rav Isser Zalman abandoned this shul. And he is the representative of the Aguda HaYadua. Shehem Kivu Orosha, they put out the light of the world. Shafru Damav, the Kitchuchayav Shomaran Abba Rav Zatzal. And they shorten the life of my father. And then he goes on to a different thing. He says, "Asher Amar Almanigam Hayadua." What did he says? My father of Cook said about their leader, that is the leader of Aguda. Who was the leader? The leader was Moshe Blau in the land of Israel. Moshe Blau was the brother of Amram Blau. He wasn't as extreme as Amram Blau, but he's pretty extreme. And he was the leader of the Aguda in the land of Israel. Let me just see here. He dies in. I'm looking up the date here. 1946 he dies. So he says, Rav Kook said it, and who? Moshe Blau. He wasn't a rabbi. Moshe Blau was the head of the Aguda. He's really behind all the attacks in the newspaper and on the Pashkevillim against Rav Kook. He really ran the Aguda, not the head of the Eda Charedit. Eda Charedit was the rabbi, if you wanted a psak, but the head of the Aguda in the land of Israel, which was really the same thing as the Eda Charedit. The Eda Charedit, the Aguda was the political branch of the party in Israel, but they were members all of the Eda Charedit. Rav Kook said about him, "Ki ha'aretz takioto," the land will vomit him out. "V'zendit kayem b'milu b'tzeit nishmato b'chutzarts," and this actually happened because he died in Chutzarts, and that's true. He died. He was traveling with an Aguda delegation to the United States, and he got this disease on the ship, and he was taken off the ship in Messina, Italy, and he died there. And then I believe he was brought back to the land of Israel to be buried. So I don't need to read the rest of it, but Rav Kook goes on into he talks about he says that this man, this Chatzuf Porush, he was protected of he was B'tselo Sh'otaish. He was in the circle of the shadow of Moshe Blau. And nevertheless, we have to know that Menachem Porush is Menudah Muhram, and he's an Apikoros Muchlat, because that's the definition of Apikoros, one who degrades sages. So he goes on and on. So this incident that Rav Isser Zalman was so involved with, and Porush was so involved with, and Porush suffered his entire life, Rav Yehuda to the end of his life never forgot it. And as Porush mentioned 20 years after this event, when he gave that interview, this went with him his entire life. Did Porush do what he's alleged to have done? I have to believe he did. There were so many witnesses there. Everyone knew it. It was a Davar Yadua that he was involved in it. Whether he was dressed as Rav Kook and was part of it, or whether he was the one who actually fired it. But the story that he told, that he happened to walk in at the time that they picked up the gun and shot to him, I don't find that at all believable. And just, we know that you're allowed to lie. Mivnei Darkei Shalom. Shanot, so I'm assuming that he told a fairy tale because he wanted to create peace, and politicians lie anyway. So that's my assumption. And okay, a few other things. After Rav Kook dies, Rav Isser Zalman gives four hespedim for him, and you have to read the hespedim to see. I mean, the way Rav Isser Zalman thought of Rav Kook, he thought of him as the Rav, I mean, of Jerusalem, as one of the Gedolim. He says, One of the things he said is that I wish that I could daven Yom Kippur davening with the same kavana that Rav Kook davens a weekday mincha. I mean, for the years that Rav Zalman, he only got really to know Rav Kook when he comes to the land of Israel, and he was completely taken with his tzidkus, with his piety and his spirituality, even though he did disagree in certain areas. A couple other things I want to mention. Rav Zalman next comes to the public fore, I think, in 1940, I believe it was, or was it 41? I forget now, with the question of the international dateline. You had a number of Jews who had made their way to Kobe, Japan. Primarily, the most important of them were the Mir Yeshiva. They made their way through through miracles. How this happened, we've spoken in the past. The Soviets actually gave them permission. They had the Sugihara visas, and they were given permission to cross the Soviet Union, which was like a 2 week trip all the way to get to the end when they can go to Japan. The rest of the yeshivas, pretty much students, pretty much remained in Vilna because Das Torah told them to go to remain. The Brisker Rav said to remain. Rav Chaim Ozer thought they should remain. The Mir Yeshiva went against Das Torah. That is Das Torah from the leading Rabbanim, and they left. And they, we all know the story how they survived. So they have these visas, and they go to Kobe, Japan. They would later go to Shanghai, but that only happens after Yom Kippur. They come there, and the question is what day to celebrate Shabbos, because there's a dispute where the dateline is. This had been an issue that was first discussed at the end of the 19th century, and there already was a community in Kobe, Japan, from the beginning of the 20th century. So Jews had already been living there and had been celebrating Shabbos on Saturday. What to do? Well, Shabbos wasn't so. We don't really have reports as to what they did. They weren't there that long on Shabbos. Later on, people mentions that there are people who observed Shabbos 2 days, or you could another option is you could do Shabbos 1 day and then Sunday, only the Torah laws. We don't really have reports as to what they were doing then. However, Yom Kippur was coming, and that was the big problem. Because what do you do? The question was, is Yom Kippur, the day was, yeah, it was Yom Kippur was coming out on Wednesday. That is according to the idea that the way the international dateline is, it was going to be on a Wednesday. And that's in accordance with the idea that Shabbos is Saturday. However, so, but they knowing that there's a dispute and, it's interesting. I've never seen any discussion of what they did in on Shabbos up to then, other than a reference where one of the rabbis says that Yom Kippur is different than Shabbos because Shabbos you can keep 2 days. But I don't know if anyone actually kept 2 days of Shabbos. Shabbos it's once a week. It's hard, but Yom Kippur is. I have to investigate it a little more. There must be some reference to it, but they didn't know what to do, and it wasn't just the Mir Yeshiva. There were other people. The Amshanover Rebbe was there, and Yad Lubavitcher was there. You had all sorts of people there. So they begin writing letters. And they also sent the famous telegram to the land of Israel, which was addressed to Rav Herzog. It was addressed to the Brisker Rav and the Chazon Ish and Rabbi Finkel, who was at that time in from the Mir Yeshiva in the land of Israel. Question being, what day do they fast? Wednesday or Thursday? Rav Herzog calls a meeting where many Gedolim come, and they determine that they should fast on Wednesday. And they didn't settle the matter of the international dateline, absolutely, but Rav Tukachinsky was there, and he had his own view, which happens to be different than what many of the other Gedolim had, but it didn't matter, because for Rav Tukachinsky also, who was an expert on this, you would fast on Wednesday, and you would observe Shabbos on Saturday. The Chazon Ish was invited to come to this meeting, and he refused because he said that these sort of matters are not settled by gatherings, and that every sage has to give his own opinion. And the Chazon Ish was really an expert in mathematics and these sorts of things. And the Chazon Ish ruled that they should fast on Thursday. Not only did he rule that, he sent a telegram to them that they should eat on Wednesday and fast on Thursday. Rav Herzog and the other rabbis with him. They sent a telegram that they should fast on Wednesday that they fast on Wednesday. I don't know if he said to eat on Thursday, but Chazanish actually said to eat on Wednesday. I heard from one of my rebbeim when I was in high school, who was in the mir in Kobe at this time, that there were some people. I didn't ask him what the Ikar position was. At least I don't remember that, but I do remember him very vividly saying that some people actually fasted both days. That is, they ate on the second day, Pachos Kashir, and we'll see what Rav Zalman says about that. But they really fasted both days, just eating a little bit. And you had plenty of Rabbanim. The Lubavitch held the agreed with Rav Herzog, so their Hasidim. There was a whole group of Lubavitch Hasidim in there as well. Shortly after Yom Kippur, everyone goes to Shanghai, and that settles the problem because Shanghai, you don't have that issue of the dateline. But the Chabad, they always had complaints that they weren't treated well by the Vat HaYeshivos. So you had all this. What was Rav Zalman's position? Because Rav Zalman is often quoted as stating that there is no international dateline. Rav Pesach Frank's position was that there is no international, there's no Torah dateline. If there was a Torah dateline, then how could the sages of the Talmud not mention it? It's not mentioned. And therefore, Rav Pesach Frank says, what you have is when you don't know when it is, if you're not sure, what do? You will count 7 days, you make Shabbos. Your Chazal tell us what to do if you don't know, but they don't tell anything about a dateline. So Rav Pesach Frank held that you can make the dateline anywhere you want. I shouldn't say anywhere you want. You can't put it in the middle of the United States. But you can make, or maybe you could, I don't know. But you make it, you pick a place. And since it's already been picked, then, and there's that, the international dateline already exists, and that's what people are doing, that's just as good as anywhere else. Because there has to be a dateline. The Chazon Ish disagreed, and the Chazon Ish, there's the Baal HaMa'or, Rav Zerachia of Provence, and he really relied 100% on the Baal HaMa'or. And the problem with the Chazon Ish is that if you read the Chazon Ish and you read people like Chaim Zimmerman, who are big backers of the Chazon Ish, it's very easy to be convinced that the Chazon Ish is correct. I'm skeptical that all the other rabbis really understood this issue. And if they understood it, I don't know if they understood it as well as the Chazon Ish. So I'm perfectly prepared to say, from my limited understanding, that the Chazon Ish is, quote, correct. The problem with the Chazon Ish's position is that it was an impossible position in the sense that people had already been living in Kobe now for 30, 40 years. And they had already been celebrating Yom Kippur on a day and Rosh Hashanah and Shabbos. And what the Chazon Ish was saying is that now you had to move Shabbos from Saturday to Sunday. And that's something that's impossible to do. You're never going to find Jews who are going to admit that, acknowledge that they're going to move Shabbos. It's just not going to happen realistically. And the opposition to the Chazon Ish, in fact, in the letter that went out, maybe even in a telegram from this group called by Chief Rabbi Herzog, which Rav Zalman attended, and it had all these rabbis, they used the language of Asur leshanot et haShabbat. It's forbidden to change the Shabbos. And that then became the rallying cry of the forces in opposition to the Chazon Ish. We don't change the Shabbos. That is, people are already observing Shabbos, they've been observing for decades. This is the Shabbos. What the Chazon Ish's point was, and he was correct, is that this was a sort of a canard to say, don't change the Shabbos, because the Chazon Ish was never intending to change the Shabbos either. He wasn't changing the Shabbos. He was just pointing out that they were celebrating Shabbos on the wrong day. But when you use the expression, it's we're not, do not change the Shabbos, it implies that the Chazon Ish believes in changing the Shabbos, when from his perspective, he just believes in celebrating it on the proper day. But it can't work. Today, if you go to Japan, the local Jewish community celebrates Shabbos on Saturday. There's Chabad houses there. Maybe these guys from B'nai Brak who go maybe for Hashgacha, they celebrate it on Sunday. I don't know. But there's no community in Japan that celebrates it on any day other than the regular day. And there are probably people listening right now who've been to Japan. There was a group from Yeshiva University that went to Japan a few years ago when they were led by one of the Rosh Yeshiva, by David Horowitz. I think David Horowitz is probably the only Rosh Yeshiva, him and Jeremy Weeder, who really are equipped maybe to do a trip like that. They also went with one of the English professors. And he wrote, David Horowitz wrote like a memoir of the trip afterwards. He mentioned even that when they went there, you know where they ate? They ate in these vegetarian restaurants. He says, we're not accustomed to this in America, but when this is what you have and that's all that's there, that's what you do. And he explained the halachot behind it. So when I'm in India, I mean, there's a Varun Soloveitchik, and they said, you go to, he told my friend that, you can eat in these like Jain restaurants and things like that. You just have to make sure that they're only serving, well, if they're Jain, they're absolutely vegetarian. So they don't even have, I mean, they won't even have eggs there or anything. But so David Horowitz explained how, what you have to look for. The assumption is that this is not Bishul Akum because it's not Olal Shulchan Malachim. So he explained that, what do you have to look for at an absolute vegetarian, a strict vegetarian restaurant? Okay, so why am I mentioning this? Because he told, he wrote this thing, which was in, I believe it was in the commentator. You could find it online. So what to do about Shabbos? There's this big machlokas between the Chazon Ish and, Rav Herzog and Rav Tukhachinsky and Tzvi Pesach Frank. What should they do when they're going? So he described how when they went there, Saturday they observe Shabbos, D'oraisa and D'rabbanan, and on Sunday they observed Shabbos, D'oraisa. And they had Dr. Lee, who's an English, I think he's an English professor at YU, he's not Jewish, he was on the trip too. So rabbinic prohibitions, like carrying things for them, whatever they needed rabbinically, he was their Shabbos guy, he took care of, and that's what they did. And when this came out, I remember reading a response to it because someone was very annoyed with this YU trip, what they did, because he says, here, these are visitors. They go from YU, when they go to Japan, Japan has a community. They have Chabad houses, they have Kehillah, and they celebrate Shabbos on Saturday. That's the Minhag HaMakom. So for these Americans to come in and say, well, no, we're also going to celebrate Shabbos on Sunday, it's as if they're insulting the local Jews, telling the local Jews they're not good enough. That if they were real Jews, that they'd also be choshesh for the position of the Chazon Ish. So at least one person who wrote a response to this thought that this was very disrespectful to the local community. I think maybe the good response would be, I don't know if David Horowitz responded, Rabbi Horowitz, he would say, it's different if you live there. If you live there, you can't have Shabbos twice a week, so then you can rely on the Saturday. But you could say that we were just there for one weekend. So for one weekend, I guess you can do both of them. Whatever, it's not important. But what is Rav Zalman Meltzer's position? As I said, he is often quoted as agreeing with Tzvi Pesach Frank that there is no dateline. And this was the position that was quoted for decades. Only recently, a few years ago, did they publish a letter that Rav Zalman wrote to the Chazon Ish explaining his position. And he doesn't actually say that. I think he implies it. I'll read it to you, but he doesn't say it. This appears, the Chazon Ish wrote a famous work explaining the dateline called Shmona Esrei Sha'ot, and then it came out with a new edition with a commentary on it, and in addition, they include letters of individuals to the Chazon Ish and also Chazon Ish's letters. So on page 71 of this, you have the letter of Risser Zalman to the Chazon Ish. So let me summarize. What he says, so we'll get his position. He says he begins by saying, "Yedidi Hagaon Shlita, my friend, the Gaon Shlita, I've heard that you sent a telegram to Japan that they should fast on Thursday." He didn't just say fast on Thursday, as I mentioned. He said not only fast on Thursday, but eat on Wednesday. That's how sure the Chazon Ish was of his position. Rav Zalman's not going to be so sure of that, and he says, "I want to raise a certain." Few points. And he quotes, and then he starts getting into the Talmudic this thing, and he disagrees with how the Chazon Ish reads certain sources. Then he explains that since there's no reason to assume that the Baal HaMa'or is an absolutely binding position that everyone accepts. How then can we accept your position, the Chazon Ish? The Chazon Ish's position was there's no doubt in this matter because the Baal HaMa'or is the first one to rule on this, and he's ruled, and he's a posek. I mean, the Kuzari writes about this and other sources. There's a book called Yesod Olam, but they're like philosophers, and Isaac Israeli is a calendrical expert, so you might say should know more than the Baal HaMa'or. But at the end of the day, this is a halacha question, so all the Baal HaMa'or. For the Chazon Ish trumps everyone else, and there's no doubt on this. The Rav Isher Zalman's not sure of this. And he doesn't think that you can make the Hechlek Gamor, that you can determine that we hold like the Baal HaMa'or, and therefore, to the extent to tell people that they can eat on Wednesday, which would be the ninth day according to the Chazon Ish. So he goes on, and then he Rishon Zalman explains there's also a, there's a difficulty in the Baal HaMaor's position. And then he says, this is paragraph three, and this is what is the basis, I believe. People knew about what he said to the Chazon Ish. This is where the idea comes from, that he holds like Rav Pesach Frank, who explicitly says there's no dateline. What does he say? Let me read it to you. Hayita Kain, Shatanaim Vamorim, Misadri Ashas. Are you going to say that is it imaginable that the Tanaim and the Moraim, who organized the Shas, Sha'amruanu Kol Davar Yesodi, who told us every important thing, the Davar Kazet, that this matter that is of a dateline, Lo Matsu Nachutz Lagidwanu, they didn't feel it was important to tell us? If Chazal didn't tell us that there's a dateline, that shows that there's no Torah Shebaal Peh, there's no Kabbalah going back that this is the dateline. Because the Baal HaMaor's position is that based upon the oral tradition, this is can must be the dateline, because this is the halacha. This is the halacha. He's not saying I invented it. He's saying this is what the Talmud must assume the dateline is. Rav Isser Zalman says if that was the case, then the Talmud would have mentioned it. And then, and apparently, and the Chazon Ish had written, and then forget that. Then he goes on. He says the Tanaim and the Moraim, they traveled on the seas and they went to islands. The Echav Shar Shorbeno Kadosh. How is it possible that Rebbe Anasi, Mesader Mishnayot, Ravashi, and Ravashi, Mesader Hashas, who has put together the Shas? Lo matzul. How can we say that if this is really part of our tradition, and Chazal told us everything about Muktzah and all these things, something which is so basic, what the Chazon Ish had said was that, if I recall, that it wasn't practical in those days because the sages didn't go, they didn't go in that area, so they had nothing to tell us, and that's to what the Chazon Ish, that's what Rishon Zalman must be replying to when he says. Hello, Hatanim v'Amorim Nasu al Yamim v'Halku achar Chayam. They went in the seas and they went to the islands. Well, that's true, but I think the Chazon Ish could reply, where did they go? They went to Rome, they went to Spain, they did that sort of thing. They didn't travel like to Japan or places like that. And then he goes on. And then he says, but the Rambam himself, and he says, the Rambam never told us, the Rambam told us everything. And yet the Rambam didn't tell us lo hodianu shum davar binyan Shabbat, even though he tells us about Kiddush HaChodesh and all that. And then Rav Isser Zalman goes further, and he says, V'achein ein anu niskakim l'meridian, v'lo gevul mizrach ma'arav. He says, therefore, we don't need to be concerned about the meridian, about the gevul mizrach ma'arav, lo l'shum halacha. And what do we know? What did the poskim tell us? And then he goes on, he says, Kizema Mela b'Kabbalah. We have a tradition. You want to know when Shabbos is? K'mo sha'anu yodi matay matchil yom ha'Shabbat shelanu. Shu b'shikiyat hachama. Just like we know when Shabbos starts with sunset. Ken yodim kol ha'makomot shebetzad ha'mizrach. B'shikiyat hachama shelahem. Therefore, everyone knows that Shabbos begins at shikiyat hachama. The problem, I don't think Rav Zalman Meltzer understood really what was going on here. Of course Shabbos begins at shikiyat hachama. But the question is it the ninth day or the tenth day? That's the whole point. I mean, he does say we're not concerned with, where east and west is. We go by what the people do. So fine, you can go by what the people do. But the people only started doing that 30 years before this. There were no Jews living there. That's the whole point. Had Jews been living there, there wouldn't have been this problem. And then he concludes. And this, he adds this really in at the end, in opposition to the Chazon Ish's position. He says, it's known, Yadua sheyesh b'Yapan yishuv sheyudim. There's a community in Japan, of Sfardim, or Ashkenazim. He was not sure which. It was actually Sfardim who were the first ones there, but they were Ashkenazim as well. But never, of al kopanim, kvar makubo etzlam yom ha-shabbat. He says that the Shabbos is already accepted by them. V'nei adata. Oh, then he says, and now that the lomdim from Lita. This was a passage I had in mind before. He says, the yeshiva students from Lithuania have come there, and they've begun to do two Shabbases. So that's he must have had this, actually, not just, this is the letter I was referring to. So we see from Rav Zalman Meltzer, he says that already in Japan, they have a Shabbos. course, the Chazon Ish would say, "Who are these people? These are not Talmid Chachamim. You had a big Talmid Chacham in Shanghai, but in Kobe, were there any Talmid Chachamim ever there? They came there, and they came from Europe, and they came in what day? Saturday. So Saturday we observe Shabbos. That's a typical Baal Batish mentality. They're supposed to know that even though it's Saturday here, this is really not Saturday from the Torah perspective." The Chazon Ish, this did not impress the Chazon Ish at all, because there is no Masorah. That's the whole point. But he says that now these yeshiva students in Lithuania have come and they've started doing two Shabbases. He says that's not such a pirtza, he says, for the majority, for the people who live there. That is, the people who live there probably weren't so observant to begin with. If the guys from the yeshiva students want to do a second Shabbos, who's going to care? First of all, who would even know? But if the guy doesn't want to do any malacha, how does that affect the local Jews? It's like people in Israel who are observing 2 days of Yom Tov. You think the Israelis pay attention or care on the second day? But then he says, "Avomikavon, shalitaim." You know, he says, but if the Lithuanians are going to change Yom Kippur, yeah, pirtza gedola. This is going to be a big problem, a pirtza, a break. The Yomru Hatzairim, and what are the young people going to say? I don't know why just the young people, the old people too. He's talking about the local people. They're going to say, "Ach sheker nachlo avotenu." That is, the people who live there, the local Jews, are going to say, "You know, you're going to tell us to change Yom Kippur from the year we've been doing it every year? You know, what kind of nonsense is this? That must be our whole tradition is based on falsehood. We've been observing Shabbos for the last 40 years on this day, and now you're going to tell me we're not supposed to observe Shabbos on Saturday? We're supposed to observe it on Friday?" And try explaining to a Baal Bus that no, it is Saturday, but it just falls out on Sunday. That's what I'm sorry. That's what it should be. That it's Saturday, that you're not observing Shabbos on Sunday. You're observing Shabbos on Jewish Saturday. This will he thinks will be a terrible break. And he says, and then the people say, "You don't know what day Shabbos is?" And then he says, "Ukvar nimtza b'sefer yashon shachach lishmo." He says, "I saw in an old book. I forgot the name." Which is based on a dispute about a mikvah. And in the notes here, it explains it's the book Mashbit Mochama, which deals with there was a huge dispute. You come on my Italy trip this summer, I'll tell you about this unbelievable dispute that took place over the mikvah in Rovigo. Unbelievable machokas of all the gedolim of Italy about this mikvah in Rovigo. And what does Rav Zalman say he saw in this book? It says that once this machoket started, people stop, women stop going to the mikveh because of this machloket. Because here, the women in Ravigo, they're going to the mikveh, and all these gedolim are saying the mikveh is pasul. So as it's, you're going to the mikveh as if you're not going to the mikveh at all, so then what do I need to go to the mikveh for? What's the point? So Rav Ishe Zalman says, that's the problem with your position, Chazon Ish. You're going to change the Yom Kippur, then people will say that our religion, it's all about the rabbis, they can make any changes they want, and when Shabbos... Now, in the note, he points out that Rav Ishe Zalman, who's citing from memory, was actually mistaken in this. It doesn't say that the women stopped going to the mikveh. I mean, stopped that the women nichshelu b'kritut. It doesn't say. Now he says that Rav Ishe Zalman Meltzer, what he says, they stopped going to the mikveh. It implies that they actually didn't go to the mikveh and slept with their husbands. And he says at the bottom here, no. All it means is if you look in the original text. All it means is that they separated from their husbands because they weren't going to mikvah. I never understood it differently. He says, actually, no, you're right. He says, "V'katu because of the great dispute, they stopped going to mikvah. Implication meaning that they didn't care anymore because of all this dispute over whether it's a kosher mikvah. And just like he says that the people in Japan are going to stop taking Shabbos seriously because the rabbis can't figure out when Shabbos is, so too they stopped taking mikveh seriously in Italy because the rabbis couldn't decide what's a real mikveh. In the note, he points out that if you look at the original text of the Tshuva from Italy, all it says is that the women stopped going to mikveh and they weren't with their husbands, but not that they stopped going to mikveh and they didn't care about mikveh. They just figured that there's if it's not a kosher mikveh, what's the point? And then he concludes, Rav Ishe Zalman concludes, I see it's already 10 o'clock. I'm going to finish up, though. I'm going to go take you another 20 minutes or so. Those who don't want to stay on, you know, I'll go. I'll keep going. You can listen to the tape, but I really want to finish this so that next semester we can start with Rav Charlap. So if I see, and I'll do it quickly. So if I see you dropping off out, it's not a problem. I'll stay on for about a half hour more just so I can finish it. And he concludes his letter by saying, in my opinion, therefore, the proper thing is that they should fast on Wednesday, and on Thursday, Sheyu Safek, we regard it as a Safek, those who are ill, they should eat Pachos Kashir. Can anyone fit? I would think pretty much every. If this were Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, he would say you have to eat something on the second day to go fast, complete day, no water or food. But he says if you can, if you feel you need to, then you eat Pachos Kashir on Thursday. But the Ikar day for him is Wednesday. That is in accordance with the Refert Saga or Tzipi Pesach Frank. And he says if there's a chashash that maybe people are going to be stringent and not eat at all, he says we can make a gezeira sheyochu pakosu shir v'lo yachmiru. We can make a gezeira on them that they have to eat on Thursday. And he says that we don't need to worry about those who won't listen to us. Okay, I don't. We don't. I don't need to go on anymore about that. Okay, so that's Rav Zalman Meltzer's position. A few other things that just to close out, just to give you a sense of the man, the modesty. I found in, and I'll get to the questions at the end. In Rav Avram Shapiro's, who knew Rav Zalman Meltzer very well, was a student of his. In his Minchat Avraham, volume one, he has a letter from when Rav Avram was a young man. It just says interesting. I just call it to your attention. Rav Avraham Shapiro wrote the Rosh Yeshiva. He's a little yeshiva bacher, and he wrote the Rosh Yeshiva a note on something that he thought the Rav Zalman Meltzer overlooked. So what does he write back to him? He writes back, "You are certainly correct. Umuvan shalonis karti b'shasha gatafti," and I didn't remember it. I mean, that's a sign of a real Talmud Chacham, one who's not embarrassed to admit that he made a mistake. I found also in Rabbi Sternbach's responsa, this is Shu'at von Hagot, volume 3, page number 12. He tells a story that he was with Rav Zalman Meltzer when a tourist asked him if he should wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. That is, a tourist from overseas. We know that in America, you have different minhagim. I mentioned last semester, though, I've seen a change. When I was young, I'm certain that it was half and half, wear tefillin, don't wear tefillin. It seems now you go into a shul, you hardly have people wearing tefillin. I think because it's easier. People have begun, even though whatever their minhag is, they've begun to do that. But he says, if someone asks, and but in Israel, the practice is, in public at least, you don't wear, forget, leave that aside, backtrack. In Israel, the practice has always been you don't wear tefillin. And people moved to Israel and they wore, it's like the Vilna Gaon, people moved to Israel, they wore tefillin. They're told they're allowed to stop wearing it. But Rav Zalman told the tourists that in private he should wear tefillin, and Rav Zalman said, and this is from Sternbach reporting, that he himself puts on tefillin on Chol HaMoed without a bracha in private, and there's no problem doing it that way. He doesn't say a bracha because, the minhag in Israel is not to, but he still puts it on. I don't know of any other rabbanim from Chutz Laaretz who went to Israel and did that. Okay, just oh, one final thing, two final things. Another thing, there, versus Zalman. This is reported by the grandson of Bederach Eitz Chaim. I should have said this before, but I just found it today. When Rabbi Zalman Meltzer did Netilas Adayim, he washed his hand. He made Netilas Adayim, and then he washed his hands. Even though we all know, what do? You wash your hands and then say Netilas Adayim. So he was asked why, and he says because the Rambam paskens like that. I don't know, do Sfaradim do it that way? I forget what if anyone knows what Sfaradim do, let me know. And what does Rav Zalman say? I, who've been involved with the Rambam for so long, as he wrote his whole life work as a commentary on the Rambam, Echuchal and Hogacheret. Lucretia Posthigo. How can I do differently than Rambam says? I find that unbelievable that the Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, because he's so involved in the Rambam, he's posking according to the Rambam, even though that's not the Shulchan Aruch. That's what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik would do. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik felt that he could posken like the Rambam in opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. But here we see Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer doing the same thing, and not because he on his own had certain ideas, like Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is like a Rishon. He can disagree with the Shulchan Aruch, but it's because Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is so attached to the Rambam. His life is revolving around the Rambam. Therefore, he feels it's okay for him. He's not posting for anyone else, but he feels it's okay for him to adopt the halacha of the Rambam. I don't know if he does. I've never heard it said that Rav Isser Zalman did this in all areas, but in this case, he did. But there's another area he did it as well. So it would be interesting to determine if this was his general rule. How about lighting Shabbos candles? The Rambam's position, this is Shulchan Aruch's position as well, is that you say the bracha, then you light it. Ashkenazim do the reverse. So what did he do? He ruled. It says here, Ho Rabbeinu he told to his wife. He told his wife to make the bracha before Hilchos Neros, also because that's the Rambam's psak. It's not because Mara D'Asra of Eretz Yisrael or anything like that, but he felt that he had a connection. I actually felt that way a little bit. I eat on I started eating a number of years ago on Pesach liquid derivatives. You know, there's a whole machlokas about kitnios derivatives. Can you eat them? Ravitzel Chanan Spector, growing up, we never ate them, as far as I remember. Ravitzel Chanan Spector said it was permissible, and the you know, in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Unterman and others said it was permissible. And the OU used to give hashgacha to it, and then they stopped. I heard from Rabbi Blau that the Rav at first approved of it, and then he changed his mind. But there are many Gedolim who approved it. And in Israel, I know that there's a move now among Ashkenazim not to eat kitnios, which I don't think is at all permissible, but to now, because it's very difficult to get foods that are not kitnios, have kitnios in them, that many Ashkenazim are starting it again because they used to eat it. Kitnios derivatives. The truth is that many of these products with kitnios, you could eat it according to the basic halacha anyway, because it's kitnios is batel b'rov. But in any event, why do I say that I adopted this? Because when I was working on the Sri Deish, I spent how many years of my life I devoted to the Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg in working on the biography and publishing the two volumes. So he has a responsum on kitnios derivatives. And he says, like he holds like Rabbi Tzolk'in Spector, and he quotes Shmuel Rav Hirsch, that kitnio derivatives are permissible. So when I read that tshuva, I felt that, you know, I felt if Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who in many ways I felt was my, you know, hero, my Rebbe, even though I never met him, but if he's holding that this is permissible, I said, okay, then I'm going to eat kitnios derivatives. I never asked a posek this. I don't know what a posek would say to me. I don't know if you need to ask a posek this when you have all these great gedolim who say that it's permissible. But I can tell you, I get a sense of what Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer must have felt like, because I felt that if the Sri Deish is saying that this is permissible, then that's I felt that I should, you know, follow in his path. And in general, I took his psukim very seriously, and so just a bit of my personal history there. And the last thing I want to tell you, which I think is very unusual, to put it mildly. I saw this a long time ago, but I've had it. I never had a chance to use it. I'm thinking of pulling it out one day in one of my blog posts. A new blog post is going to go up maybe tonight or tomorrow. So you get all sorts of tidbits as I try to give, but this isn't going to be on it. If you look in the Evan HaAzel, in Hilchos Melachim, and this is the last point I'm going to make about Rav Isser Zalman, chapter 3, Halacha Vav and Zayin, the Rambam's halacha is that a king is forbidden to drink to drunkenness, and he because he has to be in, you know, but he should be involved in Torah and in, you know, Tzarchei Yisrael and you know, making sure that the kingdom's running properly day and night. In other words, the king who has a responsibility, the king is the servant of the people. That's how the kings of Israel are supposed to be. They're not in it for themselves. They're in it to serve the people, to be the very similar to the conception of Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes. So therefore, the king can't be drunk and can't be involved with that. Because he always has to be ready. His finger always has to be there to be on the nuclear trigger. That's what the Rambam says. And then the Rambam goes on. V'chein lo yeh shatuf b'nashim. He also can't be involved in nonstop sex and things like that. As many of those kings were, they had these big harems. Why? But he says, and he shouldn't be, even if he only has one wife. Well, yeah, much like it's not tamid kishara tipshim. Even if he only has one wife, he shouldn't be involved in sexual matters all the time. And then and he quotes a pasuk there. Okay, that's what the Rambam says. Now, Rav Zalman Meltzer asks a question here. How is this different from anyone else? If the Rambam doesn't just say Tzarchei Yisrael, the Rambam doesn't just say that the king can't do these things because he has to be involved in matters of state. The Rambam also says because he has to be Osek b'Torah. The king is supposed to also be involved in Torah. So then Rav Zalman asks, how is that different from everyone else? We all can't be getting drunk and having sex all the time because we have to also be involved in learning of Torah. He answers that this special mitzvah of the king, that he's chayav lasot b'Torah yoter misharam, he has to be involved in Torah more than the other people. And then he goes on that I want to read you the passage here, that this idea, which we've just said, that the king always has to be involved in Torah and in state and can't get drunk and everything. Ze'eino ela b'melech. This is only a law for the king. Aval hedyot, an average person, a commoner, a layperson, muterlo, hitaneg. He can do this. Af sheze yigram ubitul Torah. Ve'hechreich, al yedei hashikrus o be'ilos nashim. It might not be a good thing, but for an average person, there's no halacha against them getting drunk. It's not a good thing, but if he wants to, he can. Because if he wants to hitaneg, he's allowed to. He can also have sex day and night if he wants with his wife, or if he has a few wives, even though he's not learning Torah at this time. Because this is also considered something appropriate for him. But the king, so then he explains, because by a hedyot, eino asor el levatel Torah bui kol sibah. When you deal with a person like us, an average person, there's an idea that we can't be mevatel Torah for no good reason. That's how I understand what it says, we call sibah. If you're sitting around watching television all day or just doing nothing, that's not a reason. And therefore you but however, this is a reason, he says. Now, we call sibah. Sha'azin, hu masir libo me'atorah, overall, because then, if you have no reason, then you're over on this commandment of Yasura Muvavecha, removing your heart from it. I think it's an amazing thing here. How is it that getting drunk is not a sibah? It is a good sibah, a good reason. If you're going to tell me sitting and watching TV, you're twiddling your thumbs, if you just do that all day, you're being mevatel learning of Torah, and you violate this commandment of not to remove your heart from it all the days of your life, how is it that getting drunk, that that's considered appropriate? And that's not, that is a reason. I don't get it. When I say I've had this text for a long time, I didn't discover it myself. I saw another Acharon who cites this Evan Hazel and is in wonderment. He can't, it's like he can't believe his eyes, for the very reason I told you. How is getting drunk considered a good sibah, or having sex all day considered a good sibah, that you're not being mevatel, you're not abstaining from Torah improper, Torah saying improperly, and it only applies to a king. I don't know what to make of this. This is like one of these passages you see here, and your eyes come out. And so I've held on to this passage for many years. One day I'll write about it. But lo and behold, we decided to do these classes in Rav Zalman, and so I'm sharing it with you guys before the rest of the world knows about it. When I say the rest of the world, people read the Evan Ozell know about it. But again, I came upon this not because I was learning Evan Ozell. I was learning another sefer, and he cites this as what he sees as a completely untenable position. So if you have any answers for that, it's, as I said, it's Hilchos Malachim, chapter 3, Halachot Hey and Vav. Let me now, we finished Rav Isser Zalman. I thank you all. It's been a run, six classes. It's been very good as always. I thank you for your comments and your questions. Let me now take the questions that have been asked. And just to say something about these classes, I'm going to London on Thursday. Fortunately, they arranged a whole. I'm speaking both Shabbases and during the week, and very nice. But so in discussing what to talk about, what lectures to give on Shabbos, this coming Shabbos, there's a show called Ner Yisrael. The person organizing it, it was a shock to me. He says, I love your online Torah in Motion talks. Why don't you speak about some of the Gedolim? So I'm speaking about Rav Gorin or Avad Yosef, but I had no idea that. So if you're listening right now, Michael Pollack, if you're listening, I thank you for that, and I look forward to seeing you in a few days. But it shows really the reach of these classes, that many, many more people are listening than we that join us, although only the ones who join us get to have the back and forth. And again, we have to give a big Yasha Koach and thank you for Rabbi Kelman, because even though now this is like 7, 8 years, and this is not new technology anymore, even though he was really the first one to do it, and Torah in Motion originated this sort of learning. Nevertheless, even though it's 7 or 8 years once we started, there still is nothing like this among other people. So he still is ahead of the game and at the forefront. So in many things, by the way, if you go, those of you who are new with us, go to the Torah in Motion website. You can see the lectures and the classes they have there. It's not your run-of-the-mill stuff. Whatever you find interesting, I'm sure Rabbi Kelman has already thought of it. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? They had something on LGBT issues. And so really all the interesting subjects that you've been thinking about. So Moshe from Lakewood, doesn't Rav Kasher also hold Record Frank? Yes. Rav Menachem Kasher has a whole big, thick book in which he gives the history and the documents, and it's basically a defense of this view, although not for Tzvi Pesach Frank's position. He has other reasons for it, but Rav Kasher's whole point is also that and Rav Kasher really is the one who spread this idea. He constantly repeats in his book, don't change the Shabbos, which is a canard, because no one changes the Shabbos. It's at least in reality, no one did, but I guess in the popular mind, they did. And yes, so anyone who's interested in the Dateline, you have to see Rav Kasher's book. It's called Kav HaTa'arich HaShalem. And I mean, he has a whole different theory about that. There's a difference between what's called Shabbos Bereishis and Shabbos Sinai. Rav Zimmerman really attacks, Rav Chaim Zimmerman attacks very disrespectfully Rav Kasher, and says that, he says, first of all, he says Rav Kasher doesn't know what he's talking about. And he says Rav Kasher disputes with the Chazon Ish, and people look at it and think, well, it's a dispute, there's two position sides. He says it's like if some ignoramus were to go up and start arguing with the rabbi, I'm talking about someone who knows nothing after shul, other ignoramus is looking on it, will think, hey, there's a dispute here. The rabbi says one thing and this guy says something else, when really a Talmud Chacham knows that the ignoramus has nothing to say. And that's what he says about Rav Kasher. That Rav Kasher doesn't understand the mathematics, doesn't understand the science. It's a very difficult sugya. And he says Rav Kasher is completely out of his league. The problem is that Rav Tukachinsky was an expert in this, and he also disagreed with the Chazon Ish. But I'm prepared to acknowledge that the Chazon Ish is correct. The Chazon Ish knows this better than anyone else. But at the end of the day, there's two problems. The one is that people have already been living in Japan, like Rav Zalman says, and you can't exactly, in Australia, they've been living in Australia. Actually, no, Australia is not an issue for Chazon Ish, and you can't really do anything about that. The other problem is that I think Rav Zalman said, or Tzvi Pesach Frank said, that if there really is a dateline, and it has to be here, by definition, how come the Gemara never mentions it? How come the Rambam never mentions it? It's clear, they say, that this wasn't something that needed to be determined in one particular place. The problem with Tukachinsky's opinion is, for Tukachinsky, where he puts the dateline, Japan is fine, but Hawaii needs to change the date. In the real world, we see the Pesach of, and this was the Pesach of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, this was the Pesach of Rav Herzog, and that whole base of Rav Mertzbach, Rav Yonah Mertzbach. I don't know if he's a household name. He was one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Kol Torah. He came from Germany. Yeshiva's Kol Torah is a German yeshiva, but he had a PhD in mathematics. So he really understood this area, and he also agreed that the sh you know that you go with the chief rabbinate's position. Don't change the Shabbos. Don't change Yom Kippur the way it is, which means go by the regular dateline. So it's the Chazon Ish's position really has not been accepted. If we were just starting from scratch, it probably would have been accepted, but we weren't starting from scratch. There already were communities in those places. Moshe says many Rishonim went to the Far East. Which Rishonim ever went to the Far East? I never heard of any Rishonim that went to the Far East. You mean like Marco Polo? I mean, you're saying medievals, but well, what Rishonim went to the Far East? Is it not possible the people in time of Tanaim Maramarim also did? Well, that's what Rav Zalman Meltzer says. Rav Zalman it says the Chazon Ish must have said. I have to look in the Kuntres Yud Ches Shaus. He must have said that the reason the Gemara doesn't mention this is because it wasn't practical. Because I read you Rav Zalman's reply. Rav Zalman's reply was, I'll read it to you again. This is on page 73. Halo hatanaim v'amoraim nasu al yamim. The Tanaim and Amoraim did go in the seas, and they did go to the islands. He means faraway islands. And how is it possible? Shrabbeinu HaKadosh didn't tell us. Therefore, when Rav Zalman is assuming that they traveled on this, they're obviously going on the oceans. They need to know when the dateline happens because you need a dateline. Just look at a globe; you'll see you need to have a time where it changes. And since the Tanaim and Amoraim were traveling. And they didn't tell us when, and it shows you that to them it wasn't a concern that you'd establish it wherever you established it. But I think the Chazon Ish could reply, yes, they were going in the seas, but where were they going? They were going in the Mediterranean. Maybe they were going in the Indian Ocean, but they weren't traveling out to Japan. But Rav Zalman Meltzer, it's still a good point, because how do you know where they're going to go? Once they get in the boat, you never know where they're going to end up. But that's the argument. But I don't know. If you know any Rishonim who went to the Far East, I have never heard of any Rishonim who went to the Far East. And then Moshe says, even if they didn't, wouldn't they have raised the question at least in a theoretical sense? There's so many other theoretical questions Chazal raised. That is exactly what Rav Zalman Meltzer and Ritzvi Pesach Frank say. They say that our whole life is based on Shabbos. Our whole structure of existence is based on 6 days and then Shabbos. How is it possible that Chazal would not tell us about this situation? And they knew the world was round. If you're going to say they thought the world was flat, I mean, then it makes sense. But it's not true. They knew the world. All educated people in those days knew the world was round. So it's a very difficult question, and it's precisely because of that question that Tzvi Pesach Frank says that the Torah has given authority to us to establish the dateline wherever we want to establish it. Now, you're not going to establish the dateline in the middle of a population center. And therefore, even the Torah dateline moves, it curves, because you have to establish it in some place. You'll still have a situation where you'll have a boat, one side and then the other side. But Ritzvi Pesach says that the Torah and Chazal give us authority to establish it wherever we want. And since it's already been established by the international community, and it doesn't go through any population centers, that would, because it would be a problem if, let's say, if Brooklyn is one day and Queens is another day, that won't work for all sorts of reasons. So what you're saying, Moshe, is as you are exactly repeating what Ritzvi Pesach Frank and what Rav Kasher and what Rav Zalman Meltzer say. Why Yisrael says, why won't the Japanese know the date and day? They aren't stupid. When you say the Japanese, what do you mean the Japanese? The Japanese know the date. We all know the date. The question is, what day? Where is the date line? That's the question. So that's where is the Jewish Saturday? Does the date line change at this point by Australia? Does it change by Japan? So the question isn't what day is Saturday or what day is January 10th. Everyone knows January 10th is January 10th. The question is Shabbos January 10th or is Shabbos really January 11th? That's the question. Take it out of the globe, Yisrael, and look where the date line is. And you'll see that when you pass it, then all of a sudden, either you go backwards, or you go forward. So it has to be somewhere else. So where you put the dateline, the Chazon Ish put the dateline in such a place that it's like, where does the day begin? The day begins, let's say, over here. This is, let's say, midnight, and then it's 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and then you go all the way around to the other side, and then you start over again. So the question is, where does the dateline begin? That was the question. How much? That was the only issue. Yisrael says, why did Rav Meltzer and Rav Kook adopt the Jerusalem Shrine while the Brisker Rav and maybe others did not? I don't know. It's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wore the Shtreimel. Rav Elyashiv wore the Shtreimel. I don't know why the Brisker Rav never adopted it. Maybe the Brisker Rav didn't care. You know, what does he need? Yisrael says, what was Rav Meltzer's view of the Lakewood policy of kol for all that did not exist? There wasn't such a thing. You know, Rav Aaron Cutler was also not only he was also he becomes when Rav Isher Zalman retires, Rav Aaron Cutler becomes also the Rosh Yeshiva of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, but that's only very temporary. It doesn't last very long because he wasn't going to move to the Eretz Yisrael. He remains in Lakewood. There wasn't such a thing as kol for all, kol for all. There wasn't such a thing in Israel until the late 1970s. This was only became a possibility when Menachem Begin made some agreement with the Haredi parties. Rav Meltzer's view of secular studies, like all these Lithuanian Gedolim, he had sons who turned out different than him. He has one son who's a professor, one of the sciences, I believe. So the typical Lithuanian view, he doesn't ever write about secular studies, but the typical Lithuanian view was that they're a good thing, as long as you don't take away from Torah study time. And among all these Lithuanian Gedolim, it's almost uniformly you have one son who becomes like an intellectual. I'm talking about the ones who remain religious in secular studies. So they never had opposition. Rav Aaron did, but I've never seen any evidence that Rav Zalman Meltzer had, and his son didn't. Moshe says, I think Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said the same thing Rav Meltzer in regard to filling a Chol HaMoed. He said that for tourists or for every people who live there. That I don't know. By the way, Rav Elyashiv also opposed the Chazon Ish on the dateline. I don't know where Shlomo Zalman's position was. Moshe says he thinks there's a story with the Brisker Rav. Someone asked him why he doesn't say V'yatzmach Perkanei in Kaddish, despite the fact that the Rambam had that Nusach. I don't know. They didn't follow the Rambam on everything. Yisrael says, what is a kitnios derivative? A kitnios derivative is a corn syrup, let's say. That's the most famous one, but you can have all sorts of syrups. So Coke. You get the Coke on Pesach with the yellow top. It doesn't have corn syrup. I don't know what it has, saccharin. Even though technically, and I heard this from Rav Aaron Felder, that technically you could drink the regular Coke on Pesach because it's not because it's kitnios derivatives. Because it's batel barov. Kitnios is batel barov. So I asked Rabbi Felder, he was the halacha consultant for the Chafkei. He was their posek. He said the people won't accept it. What he means is that on Pesach we're always very machmir. So even though technically, even according to people who don't accept kitnios derivatives, you could drink the coke. He said the people won't accept it. But kitnios derivatives are syrups. So that, for example, even I, a Jew, could put in the kitnios derivatives intentionally and eat them on Pesach. If you go to the supermarket, you'll see Jovia chocolate covered marshmallows. Those are under the Chafkei. And this is why I asked Rabbi Aaron Felder this question. For the week of Pesach, they take off the Chafkei Ashkacha and they put the Ashkacha of someone named David Sheinkopf. I have his book here. Let me see if I see it. I'll show you. Here. David Sheinkopf he wrote this book, Issues in Jewish Dietary Laws, Gelatin, Kitniot, and Their Derivatives. He's a Talmud Chacham from Chaim Berlin. His father was Ramosha Don Sheinkopf, who was one of the great Talmud Chachamim in America. So for that week of Pesach, he gives, and that's how I broke my tradition. Maybe I should have had a Taras Madarim, I don't know. But I started eating that on Pesach. And on the box, it's the strangest thing, on the box, it doesn't just say Kosher Pesach, it says Kitnios derivatives are fully permissible on Pesach in accord with the Psak of the Posek Hador. It uses those words, Posek Hador, Revitzel Chon Inspector. So just that one week, it's under the Hashkacha of Rabbi Sheinkopf. Because it has corn syrup in it. This is a Jewish company, they put it in. So that's what a Kitnios derivative bar. An ice cream bar where the label says Kitnios might not be Kitnios derivatives. It might be real Kitnios. You might have little nuts in there or something. So I don't know what it says. So Moshe says corn syrup, exactly. Moshe says, I find it very strange. It's mutter for a head like a king. The Nevi'im are replete with chastising drunkards. You can chastise them. Remember the Ramban? The Ramban on Kedoshim Tiyu thinks that if you do that, you're a novel Rosh Torah. But according to the Ramban, you're violating Kedoshim Tiyu. It's an actual violation. But I think the implication is for the other people, it's not a violation. It's just a bad thing. I mean, but you'd think it's Bittul Torah. If the guy's getting drunk every day, but I don't know. Check out the Evan HaAzel. Email me if you can figure something out. It's Mitch says the COR does not allow Diet Coke for kidneys. There are no hashgachas in America that allow kidneys anymore. They used to. The OU used to have, Barton's Candy used to have corn syrup, and it was under the OU. But there are no hashgachas around anymore in America that allow kidneys or kidneys derivatives. The OU now has started. Last year was the first year they have kidneys, in which they say for Sephardim only. And for if you eat kidneys derivatives, you could eat some of those products. No, they won't because for the hashgachas they have to be the highest common denominator. The highest denominator. They don't want to be the lowest common denominator. They want to be the highest one. If hashgacha, if the OU, for instance, were to give hashgacha to a product, like why shouldn't they give hashgacha as kidneys derivatives? It took them 50 years till they agreed to give hashgacha on kidneys because they're Sfardim. Why didn't they give hashgacha all these years? You could say give hashgacha it has kidneys derivatives. Whoever wants to eat that will eat that because then your hashgacha will be questioned. Then the Hasidim or the other people, Yeshivish people, will say, well, it's not reliable because they give it. And so, therefore, the Hashgachas will never give Hashgacha on something that is a matter of dispute. The only thing that they appear to be holding strong to, most of them, is quinoa. For a while, it looked like quinoa would be out because Rabbi Belsky said opposed it and Rabbi Schachter approved it. But the OU never went along with the pressure to get rid of it. But you understand, if you're hashgacha, you don't want anyone to question your hashgacha. And if you start adopting kulas, then people are going to say it's not a reliable hashgacha. I don't know if the people listening realize that the OU was not acceptable in yeshivish communities in the 1960s. It took a lot of work, and they had to do a lot of interesting things to make sure the OU was acceptable. One of the things they did is pick a posek from the right-wing yeshivos. They're going to have to pick someone else now that Rabbi Galski has passed away. They'll probably have to, and they appointed mashgichim from all the different yeshivas, but it took them a while till the OU was accepted. Years ago, these people would only eat the Hamisha type hashgachas or the OK. The OK was regarded. The big problem with the OU also was, and you can look at Hapardes and you could see the attacks on the OU, they said, how can a hashgacha? How can an organization that is full of people, full of shuls that don't have machitzas, be responsible for hashgacha? Remember, the OU had loads and loads of shuls that did not have machitzas. And this was the same organization that was giving hashgacha. So they said the OU is not a reliable organization. If they have shuls, if they allow shuls and they don't have machitzas, how can you trust their hashgacha? Today, they basically split the two. OU Kashrus is completely separate. You might even say it's a Haredi group. It's completely separate than the regular OU, although the Kashrus funds a lot of things. So no one in the Haredi world is going to say, well, OU has, it has Kohat events and it has NCSY, and therefore the OU Hashkacha is not reliable. But that's exactly what they did in the 1960s. No. Benjamin of Tudela made his way to India. Right, he did Benjamin of Tudela make his way to India? He made his way to India, the western part of India. He never made his way to Japan or anything like that. Am I wrong on that? No, he never made his way all the way to Japan. He describes, did he even make his way all the way to India? I'm not sure if he made his way to India. He made his way to Persia. And to no, he didn't make his way to India. He didn't go all the way to India. There were travelers who made their way to India. He made his way to Spain in the west and in the east. He went to Iraq, into Persia and everything, but never all the way to never all the way to Japan. No one made it to Japan. I'm trying to think who made it to India. I should know this. I'm going to India in February. I'm giving a talk on halachic problems in India, and I'm citing a source from India, of a traveler who went to India, and now it's escaping me. Okay, it'll come to me. But no, Benjamin of Tudela never made his way there. Yeah, the Radhanites, they made their way to India. But again, that's that Louis Rabinowitz wrote a whole book on them, but that's not Japan. They made their way to China also. Jews were in China. But so look, if you made your way to China, you made your way to the end of China. Okay, so someone must have gotten a boat and brought some products to sell over to Japan, but we have no evidence that I'm aware of any. Stay here, since we got one more minute. You know what I got here? You all recognize this? Encyclopedia Judaica? I'm going to open it up to Japan, and let me see. Rather than me speculating, it begins. For Jews, Japan was practically an unknown land until the mid-19th century. They describe Jews may well have participated in the limited trade with Europeans, particularly the Portuguese, carried on during the 16th and 17th centuries. So, in other words, the Encyclopedia Judaica, which pretty much always has everything you need, doesn't have any evidence of Jews until maybe the 16th century, and absolute evidence not to the 19th century. So it wasn't an issue. Simple as that. Yisrael says it's amazing that, as you say, the typical Lithuanian Rav approved of secular studies, but today their descendants do not, yet those descendants claim to be the upholders of Lithuanian tradition. It's like a new religion. My position, which I've written about in the blog post, and I think it's indisputable, is that the traditional Lithuanian position is reflected in the Ner Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore. And that is before World War II. You had the Yavne school system, which was an Aguda school system, in which they had secular studies. They did Ivrit be Ivrit. That was the Lithuanian approach. You always had yeshiva people who was Torah only. But for the masses and for the average person, it was Torah and getting a job and secular studies. And even the rabbis, their children got secular studies. They didn't see it as a psul. They didn't have a... I mean, the problem of Soloveitchik was the problem with Soloveitchik for the right wing wasn't the fact that he was a PhD. It wasn't that. It was his Zionism. If Rav Soloveitchik had a Buddhist ideology, the fact that was a PhD, they would have built him up to the sky as an amazing thing. That was never an issue. They never really had a problem with secular studies in the Lithuanian world, if it doesn't come at the expense of Torah. You can't put it in the yeshiva, though the Netziv has a letter. I published this letter in Hamayan years ago, which he wrote to his grandson, and he says that secular studies are very good, but not during Torah time. So that's the typical Lithuanian position. Bnei Brak is not a reflection of traditional Lithuania. Okay, let me finish up. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter disapproved of his son. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's son made it seem as if, well, first he thought his son would should be achieve more than that. And when one of these Haskalah magazines newspapers published something about the son and said Rabbi Yisrael is so proud of him, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter writes in and says, I'm not so proud of him. I'm not. He thought he could have been a Rosh Yeshiva. That's why. But for people who were not going to go into learning or Rabbonus, there wasn't a problem with secular studies for in the Lithuanian world. Again, that doesn't mean you go to a university, a co-ed campus, all the things. For many of the problems that developed in America, the opposition to secular studies, it wasn't about the secular studies per se. It was about the environment. That was the issue. What's the difference in old time Lithuanian and Torah Derech Eretz? By the time you get to the 1930s in Lithuania, you have the development of Torah Derech Eretz. The Yavne school system was developed. Read Rabbi Karl Bach's book. The Yavne school system was developed by the German Orthodox. The Beis Yaakov was developed by the German Orthodox. So by the 1930s, you do have Torah Derech Eretz. It's not, I wouldn't say it's high culture. That is, Torah Derech Eretz in Germany meant high culture. German literature, the opera, things like that. Because Jews in Germany were part of German society. So the culture was German. Jews in Lithuania were never part of non-Jewish society. So the Torah Derech Eretz was really at the was just to get make a living, and their enlightenment was seen in other ways. But it wasn't in the culture of the place. It wasn't in Russian culture, anything like that. Because remember, Russian society was not a welcoming society. Didn't Rivadavia Bartanuro travel to India? No, Rivadavia Bartanuro did not travel to India. Rivadavia Bartanuro left Italy and traveled to the land of Israel. When would he have gone to India? Yaakov Saphir went to India. And there were people in medieval times who went to India. The Rambam's brother, David, he went to India. But Avadi Bartanura did not go to India. If you find something, Mitch, which says that, please email it to me. It won't be true if it says it, but I'd be curious to know if anyone says that. Just any other final comments? I mean, he traveled. He went to Damascus. He traveled all over and Yemen, I think he went to, but he didn't go to India. At least I've never heard he went to India. And I speak about him when we go on our Italy trip. So if he ever went to India, this is something that I've never heard of. But I can guarantee you he didn't go to India. Okay, everyone. Good night. Thank you all for joining us again this semester. And we've gone long today, but we wanted to finish it up. So we'll see you when we see you with Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. Good night, everyone.